may be perceived, even if you're not sure, if they're perceived as a conflict of interest, you should definitely let folks know. And feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions along the way. So on the next page, we briefly explain two important standards in fiduciary law, the prudent person rule and prudent investor rule. The prudent person rule really dates back to the 1930s, is originally the prudent man rule. It means that as a fiduciary, you're managing someone else's money and you're really considering care, intelligence, and caution. As if the money was your own, you would invest it the same way. The two main reasons this was put in place was to, back then, to avoid speculative and risky type assets. But it also really had an emphasis on just judging securities at the individual level. So over time, the prudent investor rule came into existence, and that really came as the financial markets evolved and the new rules were put in place in the 1990s, and that really modernized, and it really reflected that the way people invest had been modernized, and so this statute or rule was also modernized. So instead of looking at investments in isolation, now you're considering them at the total level. So that's where that diversification comes into play. And you want to make sure that you understand the risk and return trade-offs and what you're putting together. You want to make sure the strategies align with the type of plan that you have, and that you're also making sure that some risk is acceptable, but you just want to make sure it's you're not going over the top in terms of what the goals are. It really should serve the overall objectives of the plan and of growth and security. So what does this mean in practice, which is on the next page? And if you look on the left-hand side of this page, so at the highest level, the prudent investor rule, these are the three steps or three things you should follow. You want to have investment objectives, you want to have a policy, and then you want to exercise due diligence in selecting and monitoring your investments. On the right-hand side of the page are some questions that are examples of investment decisions. Some of them may or may not apply because it's a more holistic view. For example, this does apply, but you want to know what the role of each investment is in your program. And that's not just the investment option, but it might actually be a specific asset class. If you were introducing something new that maybe you weren't familiar with, you'd want to make sure you understood what it was. So the next page is another trivia question. So being a good fiduciary is analogous to being a careful driver. True or false?
It feels like it should be.
It does.
True.
Yes. You want to, when you're driving or navigating complex things, and you want to get your passenger there in a safe and sound way. Other examples of that would be like cooking. Like if I were making you dinner and I ate all of the food before you showed up, that's probably not being a good fiduciary if I'm planning a dinner party. So I'm going to hand it off to Paula to talk a little bit more about governance and specifically your investment policy statement.
Great. Thank you, Kay. So one of the most important documents when we talk about being a good fiduciary and the governance model is the investment policy statement. So page 40 with the slide that you see here, really there's a lot of information here, but what to remember about the IPS, an investment policy sets clear guidelines for managing assets. It's essentially a framework for making effective decisions. So you'll notice when we go through the document or your own document, a big part of the IPS is the roles and responsibilities section, which really breaks down the board duties, in some cases, what can be delegated and who are the major players that are also serving as fiduciaries to the program or to the board. A couple of things why it's important, I'd say, I won't read through all of them on the right hand side, but things that kind of are to be highlighted. It helps committees meet fiduciary responsibilities. That's one of the key reasons why we have an investment policy statement. It helps mitigate risk. That is central to your role as a fiduciary. And it also maintains consistency even when board members or staff change. As we all know, board members may come and go, there could be turnover, but that document needs to exist and be preserved and maintained, always current, so that anyone can step into that role of a fiduciary and know exactly what standards are held to. Next page. I also want to remind the boards that this is certainly it's a living and breathing document. It is not a set it and forget it. So each year it gets reviewed, even if the review, the outcome of the review is minimal or no revisions, it's critical that it still gets looked at regularly. So what are the elements of an investment policy statement? So this page essentially shows you the typical components of what you would expect in that plan document that are considered best practices. We included the same page last year. Again, I think it's just important to refresh one's memory, or for some folks, this might be new, but it should look and feel similar and be aligned with the IPS that's written in for the respective programs. For Oregon Saves, you might recall in August, there were some pretty big revisions, particularly in the section of roles and responsibilities, where there was language added in terms of responsibilities of the board and of the executive director, as well as the investment committee. And then there was also information as it pertains to the program manager and account holders. So I'd say that was a pretty big revision to the latest IPS. There was also noted on proxy voting, which you typically may or may not see, really depending on the program or the entity.
Maybe before you move on, I think another important thing to ask you is why?
Yeah.
Why do you do this? And it's really to why the cadence of every year we look at it. And, things change. So the whole purpose of it is to make sure that you're identifying any weaknesses or gaps in your policy for best practice. So we want to make sure that you're doing it on an annual basis, which you guys are.
Yeah. I think the approach is always, every year we look at it with a new lens and see how we can improve it. We're not there to make necessarily changes for change's sake, but we want to make sure that it is as polished as best can be. Next page, we interrupt for a true or false. Both Oregon Saves and Embark added two new sections to their investment policy statements in August 2025. Now, I think I just gave it away. So is it true or false?
It's false. The 529 plan had the roles and responsibilities already in it, but you did make some changes. So
there were minor revisions.
It's kind of a trick question.
It was. Again, this is just sort of a typical framework. You see the different sections that should be included in an IPS. You'll see a lot of similarities both between the two IPSs, between the Oregon Saves and the 529, and then just generally across the board. These are the main features that were discussed in the best practices. So, and that's about it as it pertains to the investment policy document. This page, I will end this section with one word, repeated three times: process, process, process. It's really important to recognize or know that good decisions can have bad outcomes. So as a board, we aren't judging you for the bad outcomes. We're really making sure that the strong processes are in place to avoid those bad outcomes. So what's important is that there's a clear, established process to follow. And the IPS is one of those governing documents that allow you to succeed in that way. So I will read out one of the bullets there that's particularly important, which is fiduciaries are judged on how decisions are made, not the investment results. Again, process over outcome. All right, and with that, I will turn it to Kay, who is going to cover the fiduciary liability component.
Thank you. So when we're thinking about what you're exposed to, we want to just make sure that you understand that you are exposed to fiduciary liability and know what that means. So if a violation of duty is if you act in a way that conflicts with your duty of care, loyalty, and obedience. And examples of that would be for care, if you are making decisions and you're not reading up on what you're making the decision on, you really should understand what it is and know. You could be held for negligence, right? You really need to understand the risks that you're maybe injecting into a plan. For loyalty, that goes back to that conflicts of interest. You really want to make sure you're not doing things where you could be impaired by some other thing that's happening outside of your board responsibilities that's influencing you, or you may benefit ahead of the participants. And that could result in lawsuits or reputational damage, not just to you, but to the board itself. So we want to be careful of that. And then lastly, obedience. This would be if you're misuse of funds or ignoring the regulations or requirements, and that can really trigger an enforcement action. So in short, fiduciary responsibility isn't just a legal obligation, it's also a moral one. And it's, you know, something that you really want to make sure that you're being a good steward of the plan itself when you're thinking about decisions that you're making.
Can I just add, I mean, you might be getting to this later, but I just wanted to add here that we're also responsible for each other.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, it's important not only to just sort of stay in your own lane and think about yourself, but also to think about the actions of your co-fiduciaries, because you're responsible. If you see a co-fiduciary going off track and doing something that could potentially be a breach, it's your responsibility to sort of, you know, get them back in line. Or at least to call attention to it. So that's important.
That's a great point. That's a great point.
That's a really good point. All right. So the next page is another trivia question, which is how can you mitigate your fiduciary liability? Active involvement, understand your duty, attend meetings, and follow processes.
All of the above.
It's all of
all
the above.
All the above.
Yeah.
Which is another.
All those things.
Which is a little bit of a trick question because I don't see in all of the above options.
Yeah, I guess they're all trick questions. And
we're
there's
making it harder as you noted that.
So there were a couple things that were missing from those four, though. Anybody remember what they are? One of them is what we're doing right now. Training, yeah. And then avoid conflicts of interest. That's a big one. So as we just, you know, we just talked about fiduciary liability. So we just also, it's not just a theoretical concept. So we wanted to put together some things that we think are important that, you know, the answers to, and that's really on the next page. And if we're just going to, we've grouped them in four different categories, but if we started in the upper left, so when we're thinking about fees, we want to make sure that, you understand who's getting paid, how much, and what are they doing for you. So those are key things that maybe if you don't know, we should find out. And so you have a better idea in terms of what all that means. And then if I were just to pick one other bullet on this page in that box, it's when you think about fees, you want to make sure that there isn't one participant that's or cohort of participants that's carrying the load, right? You don't want to have, if all the program manager fees were only on one option, that wouldn't really be fair to the people that have no fee on their option because the other people are paying for the plan. So you just want to make sure they're distributed equally or as equally as possible. And then for investments, you really want to know the specifics and details. So, you know, we talk about things kind of in high levels. Do you have a policy? Do you have a way to monitor the funds? And yeah, you do, but you want to know what that actually is, what the details are in terms of that. There's a few other things on here as well, like how often are the portfolios rebalanced? That gets more into the mechanics of things, but just know a little, go a little bit deeper, I guess, and make sure you understand those things. And then the next one would be compliance and operational. This is really just making sure you come prepared to the meetings. You're reading the materials before you get here. If you have questions, you're asking them. Understand how you're communicating with your participants across the different plans. How are they learning about the plan? What are we telling them? It might even be worthwhile knowing, like, how do they sign up? Have you tried to sign up to see what that experience is like so that you could relate to the participants that are in the plan? And then lastly, just some other considerations, and you've heard a lot about it today, not just from us, but from your other partners, and I think you'll hear about it more later from the 529 folks, is just understand the industry landscape. What's going on in this plan, but also have that larger contextual view on what's happening outside of the plan, and then understand the mechanics of how the plan works as well. And that's really it for that. But we also, on the next page, we included some questions that can continue to build your knowledge. And I won't go through all of these, although there is a typo on the page. If anybody can find that, you can have a piece of candy. So just to list a few things, and this is just be curious, right? If we're talking about something new, think beyond today and how your program's structured. You know, what's driving the outcomes of the market today? Earlier today, you talked about the Mag 7. You know, is that going to persist? Are there other trends like that happening? Know what they are or have an idea of what's on the forefront. What's driving performance of the individual managers? If you have a manager that's not doing well, those are the ones we tend to talk about the most. But if you have one that's doing really well, it's probably worthwhile to maybe take a closer look at that manager as well. So I'll pause there before, because we're going to switch gears and talk about plan design. If there's any questions on any of those topics, do a little time check too. All right. Well, the next page on page 50 is what we call the big picture when you're thinking about your plan. And we've organized it into four different items or sections. The two on the left, the blue and the green, those we believe have the biggest impact on the portfolios. And then the two on the right, the implementation and monitoring, they're more day-to-day. But the things that have the biggest impact are your policy objectives. What are you doing? How are you doing it in terms of how the portfolios are structured? You're figuring out your menu. You're figuring out your asset allocation. All of those things, they do take a lot of time, but once you've done it and you have something in place, it's it becomes, I don't want to say rote, but more routine in terms of you're still reviewing it. You're probably looking at it annually from your asset allocation standpoint, from your underlying funds. You're probably looking at those quarterly. But the things on the right, they take up a lot of time, right? Things get implemented. You're monitoring. You're looking all that stuff quarterly. Again, it's the day-to-day type things. If we flip to the next page, so you go through that process and you come up with your menu design. This really just shows you some of the differences of the three different plan types. But I think the thing to look at are the boxes kind of to the right where it tells you what's the most popular choice. So for both the auto IRA and the 529 plans, most folks, if not all, are in either the target age or enrollment-based options, depending on what type of plan you have. You guys don't have age-based, but you have enrollment. And then for the ABLE, it's really the FDIC option. That's where most of the money is in those types of plans. On the next page, we've shown the information in a little bit different way, where we're highlighting the complexity and risk levels of the different options. And we showed this page last year too. I don't know if we talked about it this way, but I think it's important to think about how what you have option allowed on your menu in terms of you want to have aggressive, not really aggressive, but more complex options, as well as easier things to understand. So the most easy to understand are the target or enrollment date portfolios. Most people know those. If you move further to the right, things get more complex. These are individual options where people are really building their own portfolios. Now, on the 529 side, you know, that's what you want for your advisor plan, MFS. I mean, those are the types of options you want so they can do their own thing because they understand the picture, the broader picture of the participant, the advisor does. So you want to make sure you have a mix of the different things here. And then when it comes to, you know, managing investments, there are two critical parts of that, and that's selection and monitoring. So we wanted to spend just a couple minutes talking about that And again, there are lots of words on these next few pages. On page 53, we're really talking about selection the most. And if you just go down to the bottom and look at the best practices, I think that's probably a good place to start. When we think about selection, we really think of it as a funnel. So you're starting out by thinking about, well, what do I want? And you might say, our asset allocation review said we want a large cap manager. Okay, great. So you have identified the asset class you want. So that's step one. So in that step, you want to make sure you understand the objectives and the risks associated with that, why you're doing it. And then part two is figuring out how you're going to fill that bucket with a manager. So then you would look at a variety of managers maybe to figure out which one's the best fit for the rest of the portfolio, as well as making sure that you understand. And I'm sure there's rules that you guys have or criteria in terms of selecting a fund. You probably don't want to select a fund that just started yesterday, right? That doesn't have any money in it. You don't want to represent a large portion of a certain product that a manager has. So that's really step one. And then step two is the monitoring, which is highlighted in a little bit in more detail on the next page. And I'm just going to point out a couple things on this page, and then we'll go to the next one because I think it gives more detail. So when you're thinking about monitoring the portfolios, we really think of that more as the underlying funds, but you are also monitoring MSRB or municipal securities, right, at the top level as well. So we want to make sure that the process you have in place is repeatable and measurable. So you want to have specific criteria that you're looking at. And it's not that it's going to be perfect, right? It just gives you a screen, if you will, of like, oh, you know what? Maybe I should focus on this manager a little bit more. And examples of what you should be looking at, in our view, are on the next page. You want to make sure the process that you have incorporates both qualitative and quantitative aspects. The quantitative things are listed more on the left. This is more formulaic, right? You're looking at performance, you're looking at it versus a benchmark and a peer group. And then you want to make sure you understand if the fund's underperforming, you want to understand why. Because maybe it's reasonable based on the investment style. Large cap growth is a great example of that right now. And has been for many years, as it's difficult, especially for mutual funds, to outperform that index just because of that concentration. Many of those mutual funds, there's certain rules that they have to follow. So there's just no way they can invest in the same way the indexes with that huge amount in one or seven different stocks or five different stocks, depending on the time frame. And then we also want to look at qualitative things. And those are things that are non-performance issues. So maybe a portfolio manager changed, maybe the company itself got bought by another company. So you're going to ask yourself, okay, well, what changed? Is it the people, process, philosophy, maybe the organizational structure? And then you want to think about the implications of those changes and how they impact the fund or investment that you have. Is it a distraction? Is it positive or negative? Is it going to change the culture? Those types of things. So those you want to review and consider when you're monitoring your funds.
Yeah, I think we often look at particularly the investment process of a manager. If the manager says it's a value-oriented manager, you want to make sure that it's sticking to what they say they are doing. Not oftentimes, but particularly in an environment where, for example, growth-oriented stocks are really driving the market these days, you want to make sure that a value-oriented manager who will typically not buy technology stocks isn't now dipping their toes into that universe just to kind of pick up some returns. So it's those qualitative factors and the adherence of making sure they're following through on their stated commitment. That's another example.
Any questions on that before we're going to talk about fees next. So normally when we talk about investments, fees kind of get shoved to the side. So we wanted to make sure that we reviewed those. And if we look at page 56, we can see the three different elements. Make sure we're staying on time here. Three different elements of fees. So there's underlying fund fees, there's state fees, and there's record keeper fees. The two in the middle, those two blue circles, are more operational costs and things that you have more control over. The underlying fund fees, you don't really have any control over that unless you have a separate account. So those are what they are. And then the three together make up what the participants pay. And why does this matter? Because fees directly reduce the outcomes for participants. So we want to make sure that we're monitoring those and that they are reasonable in terms of how things are structured. And let's see, on the next page, we just go into some more detail on the different types of fees, which are in that bottom table there. I won't go over that, but in terms of best practice, so you want to make sure you're transparent in terms of disclosing what the fees are, and again, that they're equitable across the plan, and that you're trying to minimize fees as much as possible, and that you look at your fees, benchmark them. Maybe you want to look at them versus the peer group of a certain type of investment manager, or even at the program level. And we just want to ensure that they're reasonable relative to the value that they're provided. And so before we move on, we did provide a checklist here that is for fiduciary oversight. We think it can be helpful. It might help you, stay accountable, give you a list of things to think about. And there's not really a whole lot more to say on that other than it's a summary of what we've already talked about. And before I hand it off to Paula, I'm going to ask you a question about money. So what is the largest denomination of U.S. paper money ever printed? 1,000, 50,000, 100,000, 1 million. Any guesses? How much? 100,000 in 1934. And it was after gold was no longer used as a standard. It was a very short period of time. They stopped printing them in 1940. So, in case you're interested, wouldn't that be fun to walk around with a bill like that?
Yeah. I'd like to know who has a $100,000 bill.
Where were you? Where
apparently
were you?
Nobody.
Yeah.
All right, so we will we will close off the fiduciary joint training with a couple of investment concepts. These should all be familiar to you or a refresh or perhaps new. Feel free to ask away if there are any questions. I will try to sort of run through these relatively quickly. And in looking back, I think this would have been a great way to incorporate more quizzes on the investment concept and have you folks answer all of these. So we're going to start with active versus passive investing, what both of them are. In short, active management, you're essentially paying someone to beat a bogey. Typically, that bogey is some sort of a reference index or, standard universally index. So, for example, a growth manager might be hired to beat the Russell 1000 growth index. So you're paying fees for that, with the expectation that they're going to beat the market. That is different than passive management, which is typically what we see in a lot of, at least in the Oregon Saves programs. The 529 is more a combination of both active and passive managements. So both are used across plans, I'd say. Passive management is one where you're trying to gain exposure to the market, but not necessarily, and you're trying to meet that market exposure, oftentimes after fees, because you are paying a de minimis amount of fees for the index replication. You'll be slightly behind from a performance standpoint, but again, it's you're looking to gain exposure to the market itself. Next page. So what is a benchmark? A benchmark is a standard we compare an investment against to see if it's performing as expected. We need to know and evaluate how our funds have done. And so we look at it from both an absolute standpoint, from a total return, as well as a relative standpoint. And that's where the benchmarks come in. Most commonly, we compare performance to an index, and that's on the left-hand side, as well as to peers to really better understand results. And this is where it goes into, kind of making sure that the manager is doing what it says it's doing. Oftentimes, as Kay had mentioned earlier, It's not only those folks that are underperforming significantly, but that are really outperforming, and perhaps you need to dig down deeper. The benchmark allows you to see that sort of outperformance. So the index shows how the market itself performed, while the peer group shows how similar funds with similar goals performed. And then finally, in terms of benchmarks, there's benchmarks for every type of investment strategy out there. You've got the Russell 1000 value, the small cap growth, you've got US, non-US, et cetera, et cetera. So a myriad of indices to compare your manager against, depending on what category your manager falls under, of course. Next page. This is just an overview of the asset classes. Essentially, what this slide shows are the main asset classes that we tend to invest in these programs. That is stocks, bonds, and cash. So each with different levels of risk and return. Stocks providing the growth component of the portfolio, so the growth engine. Bonds providing income and stability, offsetting the sort of higher volatility that comes with investing in stocks. And then cash offering the liquidity. But when you add these together, they form the building blocks of a well-balanced portfolio. And so that's sort of the key point. Next page. Again, this slide kind of shows you the full landscape of investable stocks and bonds. And really the key messaging here is they come in all shapes and sizes. You know, you can invest in different parts of the world, both with stocks and bonds. Within stocks, you know, you can look to invest in value-oriented or growth. That would be a style factor seen there in the bucket. Size also comes into play. You know, you have the decision to invest in these mega names or these smaller cap names. When we look at bonds, we consider things like issuers and credit ratings, amongst other things. Next page. All right. Diversification should be viewed by board members strictly through the lens of portfolio structure. True or false?
False.
Correct.
And so the other thing you should think about is just you want to make sure you have diversification in terms of the options that you have on your menu.
Yes, and if you recall, there was, when we looked at the investment option lineup, I believe it was New Jersey who offered a lot of different options, and then we have some folks who offer, you know, more of a limited amount of options, but diversification is key. So asset allocation and diversification, essentially, what is the difference? So asset allocation is what you hold. So in this example, an asset allocation would be a composition of 60% stocks and 40% bonds in a portfolio. The diversification sort of layers on the risk and how the securities move together, which we'll talk about more in providing a specific example on the next page. But it is the movement of those assets. You know, oftentimes we talk about the combination of stocks with fixed income because these two tend to move in different directions. So when stocks tend to crater or go down, you have your bond sort of protecting the portfolio and offsetting it because it moves in different directions. So next page, we'll walk you through an example. So let's just draw our attention to the first two portfolios. So the first portfolio, labeled the bond portfolio. This is a portfolio made up of 100% bonds. And based on the analysis, we have a return expectation coming out of that portfolio of 3.1% return with a standard deviation of 5%. If you look to the diversified portfolio A, we have about 60% in bonds. And what we do with the remainder, we have 20% invested in stocks and then another 20% invested in cash. The result of that portfolio is a higher return of 4.3%, but a standard deviation that hasn't changed. So we ask ourselves, well, how is that possible? We just included stocks into this portfolio. And just so you know, when you think, when we think about kind of the risk spectrum, we think of cash being on the far end of one, kind of the least risky, bonds have picking up a little bit more risk, and then equity or stocks kind of having the greater risk levels. So why are the returns greater? Well, this is because of diversification. Again, by spreading investments across different asset classes, when one is struggling, you have the benefit of another asset maybe doing better. So overall, it helps reduce the overall risk. The diversified portfolio B is essentially walks you through the same concept, but rather than a higher return, what you see is same return of the bond portfolio, but lower risk with the combination. Next page. And this is important, you know, because the idea that each asset class plays a role. We like to use the analogy, I'm not a sports person, but we as a firm like to use the analogy of a baseball team. And in a baseball team, you do not rely on one player, you rely on the entire team. So you have your pitcher, you have your person at bat, you know, you've got your folks on base, and you're not relying on a single person to win the game for you. So each asset class has a specific job in the portfolio. In the case of these plans, stocks, you know, it's a smaller combination of stocks, bonds, and cash. We kind of referenced the goal of each. But again, I think the importance here is there is a role to be played for each one of them. Next page. Okay, so what is considered the only free lunch in investing? And I think everyone will be taking a piece of candy with this one, I hope. A, compound interest. B, diversification, which we just covered. C, value investing. Or D, none of the above. Now, when we looked at the portfolios in the previous page, by combining some assets, recall we were able to pick up higher returns with that. The answer is B, diversification. Not a trick question, but maybe not the. We'll keep going. How about that?
Just a time check. We have about 5 minutes.
Okay, 4 minutes. I see. Okay, so I'll be quick. The glide path. Again, you should be familiar with this graph. This is a hypothetical but typical glide path of a target date fund, and in short, the glide path is the roadmap for how a target date fund shifts its investments over time, becoming more conservative as we near retirement. What that means is reducing the equity allocation and increasing more of the bond allocation. And you see that with the colors. Equity is in blue, and that, you know, it starts off pretty steady, and then it eventually declines down to a lower allocation. There are two approaches used in the construction of the target date fund. One is to retirement, which essentially reaches its most conservative equity allocation at retirement. And then there is a retirement glide path, which is through retirement, where it maintains a steadier and higher equity allocation with the idea of, you know, trying to offset the longevity risk. You know, we're all here for a little bit longer, hopefully, and we need that money to sustain ourselves. Next page. Types of investment risks. Essentially, this just shows all the different, there's a myriad of different types of risks. These are just some. You've got market risk. You've got regional, sector, and industry exposures. You've got factor exposure, size, and style. We talked about the concentration risk, which is not here, but certainly something that we've been seeing in the marketplace with the Mag 7, et cetera, et cetera. And next page. So standard deviation is a common measure of risk. There's, like I mentioned, there's a variety of ways to define and measure risk, but standard deviation seems to be one that is universally accepted, and it kind of speaks the language. If you think of it this way, it's a sort of a statistical way of measuring how much investment returns or portfolios essentially swing around a certain average, right? So the bigger swings around the average is translates to more uncertainty, which is akin to greater risk. And the more narrow means there's more of a steadier return pattern to be expected. So this is the visual. If you look to the far right on the range of outcomes, this essentially demonstrates that that concept. So portfolio A has a standard deviation of 5 versus portfolio B that has a standard deviation of has a standard deviation of 10. Both portfolios have the same expected return, but again, one just tends to have more swings, and the range of outcomes is certainly wider on portfolio B as a result. Next page. Okay. Question: which one of these terms is commonly used in economics or finance? Is it monetary echo, B, animal spirits, C, inflation shadow, or D, universal order?
Animal spirits.
Ding, ding, ding. Yes, correct. Animal spirits.
It really has to do with the concept of rational model. Like, they don't always work, right? Like, your confidence level that people or human behavior, they do things that is contrary to a rational model. And so, like, a good example of that are bubbles, right?
Okay, I'll be quick because I know we're running out of time, but essentially here's just a list of the top U.S. economic indicators. Why do we look at these factors and track them? Because they do shape the investment landscape. And so when we talk about all these things, what we're really asking is, how healthy is the economic environment our portfolios are operating in, right? So they essentially just give us the context for evaluating the risk return and the portfolio positioning. The next page just shows you the visual graph of some of these key economic indicators. You know, you should see something similar from your investment consultant. But this is just an economic and market update example. Next page. Quiz question, true or false? GDP, consumer price index, and employment are leading indicators. True or false? Fire silence.
They're like, because they're all backward looking. You're going to talk about the yield. The only one on the previous page that was the leading one with the yield curve. And it's updated daily. You can just think about the frequency of the way the information is published.
This page, I mean, essentially this chart shows the basic trade-off of investing, right? So to earn higher returns over time, you generally have to take on more risk. And so what you see here on the y-axis is the expected return, and then on the x-axis, the expected risk measured in standard deviation. As you move to the right and as risk increases, you generally see an increase in expected return. But I think that's also the importance of both asset allocation and diversification. You know, while these certain asset classes have higher risks, by combining all sorts of different asset classes, you can kind of, you know, minimize that, control that somewhat. And then finally, the next page, really, I'm a big fan of this page. I know that hopefully this should be pretty familiar. It's pretty standard across the industry. But really, here is this idea of never put all of your eggs in one basket, because you really don't know that, you know, one year you can have an asset class that is the best performer, and then the following year that could certainly fall down below. So by having a portfolio that is a mix of different asset classes and is well diversified, what you can do is, you know, sort of narrow the range of outcomes. And the black line, the black dotted line, kind of shows you where the diversified portfolio stacks up in terms of annual returns relative to just the standalone asset classes. denoted in the different colors. So, and that concludes the investment concepts, but not the questions. What was the first credit card? Was it American Express, A, Diners Club, B, MasterCard, C, or Visa, D? Correct. Absolutely. All right. Well, that concludes our fiduciary training. Any questions? I know we're about 4 minutes behind.
Any questions from either board? Great. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. We're going to take a very brief break. And then we come back with this conclusion of this portion of the fiduciary training. I can now, I believe I can adjourn.